definition of content marketing, just compare this. I mean, I wrote this, so it's a little bit of, you know, so I, you know,
Hello and welcome to episode 194 of the Rockstar CMO Effing Marketing Podcast. It's Saturday, the 2nd of December. I hope you've had a great week and you are well and staying as sane as you feel you need to be. I'm your host, Ian Truscott. I'm a three-time CMO and now a marketing strategy advisor. And in this weekly podcast, I aim to share the marketing street knowledge that I hope will inspire your inner rockstar with the help of chums I've met on my journey from sysadmin to CMO. Come and say hello. You can find links to me and my guests in the show notes at rockstarcmo.com, along with our blog and our newsletter. This week, Jeff Clark is back after his Thanksgiving break. We discuss a one-hit wonder, Stevie Wonder, and Wonderwall of creating case studies. Bear with me on that one. Hopefully it'll make sense. And Robert Rose is in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar sharing his thoughts about owned media over a cocktail. But first, we need to pay the bar tab. I'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Heiler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On to our first segment, the Rockstar CMO Studio with Jeff Clark, our resident strategy advisor, former Forrester research director. And this week, we both have tips for creating case studies.
Welcome back to our studio.
Thank you, Jeff. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's and thank you for giving this me in the studio a Thanksgiving break here in the U.S. But it's good to be back on and talking about all things marketing.
Splendid. And how was Thanksgiving for you?
Thanksgiving was very nice, quiet with friends and. Weather was okay. I think we might have a little snow on Thanksgiving and starting to feel a little wintry here, but otherwise good.
Good, good. Very nice. Yes, it's starting to feel a bit wintry here as well. So have you got snow yet?
It's only been a little bit. Only we get like a half an inch and then it goes away by as soon as the sun comes out. So nothing to write home about.
Yeah, but there has been some serious snow, hasn't there? North of you or...
Northeast, everywhere we're here.
Wow. That's cool. All right. Well, I'm sure it's coming, man. I'm sure it's coming.
Yeah.
So that's the weather sorted out, and that's Thanksgiving sorted out. Thank you, Jeff, for coming back. And then, but when you were last on episode 192, we discussed focusing on differentiated content that the robots can't write. And there were a number of different rabbit holes we kind of sometimes fell down and sometimes skipped over. And one of those, we love our rabbit holes and we love avoiding.
I still haven't found Alice in Wonderland and done any of these holes.
I'm sure you will, mate. I'm sure you will. But the, I mean, if we talk for long enough, Alice in Wonderland's bound to crop up, and we can. And anyway, one of those things we talked about was case studies, which is a big topic for both of us. Something we're both pretty keen on doing, which is kind of a banal thing to say about a B2B marketing strategy that's so important. I mean, and some people call them success stories, some people call them testimonials, and I guess that through this conversation we'll probably switch around on both of those. But what we are agreed on is they're the gold standard of content that strives to be authentic rather than the rubbish that competitors or ChatGPT can churn out. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? This is your unique story, your differentiation, how you can tell your story is through your case studies, right? Nobody else can do
Absolutely.
That. Anyway, so then I was thinking, in a change from our normal, you go away, you see, and I start having ideas. It's very dangerous. And
I
in a
change,
and in a change to our normal format of five effing things, I thought this week, because we both have a lot to share on the topic, we could both suggest three things: a one-hit wonder, a Stevie Wonder, and a Wonderwall. What say you?
I'm wondering what the hell you're talking about. But no, I like the alliteration there.
Yes,
but maybe for our listening audience, you could explain a little bit. I mean, one hit wonder, I think we get. So yeah. Where's Stevie fit in, and what do you mean by the Wonderwall in this case?
Well, in previous episodes, as regular listeners might remember, we used to talk about industry trends, and we'd say whether it was a one-hit wonder or a Wonderwall. Basically, was it a good thing or was it a bad thing? Simple enough, right? So as you say, one-hit wonder, something that people think is good, but it probably won't last, right? And then the Wonderwall, actually, before we were saying this is a hit, it's a Wonderwall, right? And I looked into actually what the song was about, and according to an interview, it's actually about an imaginary friend who's going to come and save you from yourself. So the one hit wonder, we both know what that is. Stevie Wonder, what I was thinking here was, this is a timeless tip. This is like Stevie Wonder, a talent that has stood the test of time, and you know, he's a great storyteller himself, so you know, fits into the case study thing. So I'm going to ask you for your one-hit wonder, your Stevie Wonder, and your Wonderwall. What do you think? Does that sound good?
Okay, that sounds good.
All right. So let's kick off.
Let's go.
I don't know why I've created the most complicated game in the world, but let's give it a go. So the first one is one-hit wonder, Jeff. What's your one-hit wonder for case studies? Well,
yeah, and, you know, when you brought this up, you know, I was thinking about how, you know, I've been involved with trying to get a number of stories out where, you know, your company does something extraordinary. And I mean, truly extraordinary with a client, you know, as in extraordinary, something that you don't usually do, you know, and you get it in print, you do a video, you get some press, whatever. But if it's something you can't reproduce,
right,
then it becomes, I mean, it becomes something that you know, I get you some notoriety perhaps, but I remember being involved, company that had a client in a bank in Singapore that did this bank of the future. And they used our software to kind of create this retail banking experience that was really different, but you know, it required a lot of the intelligence IP at the customer and our professional services people who, you know, we couldn't recreate that outside of Singapore, let alone, you know, in Australia or Hong Kong or whatever.
Yeah.
And so it was, so it becomes a nice shiny object, leaves a good impression, but it's not kind of like what I remember one of my sales leaders I used to work with. It's like, you want to create a lighthouse solution. It's like you say, here's something that we've done. We can do it for you. And you know, we could do it over and over again. We've certainly done success stories like that, but the extraordinary one-hit wonder one, it doesn't have any value. It's just short-term. Yeah. It's a one-hit wonder.
Yeah, I like that. And you've really embraced that one-hit wonder concept. And I also liked your very precise definition of extraordinary, in that it's something that you don't normally do. And by the way, it just sounds like many of the demos I did when I was in pre-sales. The things we used to build. Oh my God, I don't want to think about that. All right, so do I introduce mine or do you now ask me? It's a new format.
I'll ask you. So do you have a one-hit wonder in your past?
Mine's quite dull, actually, in comparison, because I think the one-hit wonder for me is the fact that a lot of B2B marketers think that a case study is customer has a problem, magic happened, and the hero product rode into town, and everything was wonderful. Ta-da! Everything's good. And I think that's got old. I think that whilst we do absolutely say that case studies, success stories, testimonials are the golden content, done badly, I think it just creates a level of cynicism with the customer. Oh, really? Oh, they had that problem and you solved it instantly. Wow. You know what I mean? So I think the bit I think that's increasingly interesting for prospective customers, and what makes the customer story asset so valuable is when you tell the whole story. And it might show a bit of vulnerability, but also what that does, it means this content asset is valuable across the whole journey. Because if you describe at the beginning, how did you discover you had this problem? How do you define this problem? What were the other solutions you looked at? What were you doing before? That's really good top of funnel educational content. Mm-hmm. And as you dive down and say, oh, I love the features, I love the way the workflow worked, or I love the fact it's orange, whatever it is then bottom of funnel stuff. And you're then talking about that and how support was really good and all. It's important, but it's a bigger story. And if you can tell a bigger story, it's going to be way more valuable, I think, for your content marketing. So I think that old structure of problem, solution, that's my one-hit wonder.
Got it. Certainly agree with you in that most customers that are doing research are looking for, do other people have similar problems that I have, and did they solve them? And so that's where your expanded story makes absolute sense.
Yeah, yeah. And what that journey was they went on, absolutely. So we'll move on to the next one in this game. This might work. This might actually work. it's on to our Stevie Wonder. So this is that timeless tip, like Stevie Wonder. It's a thing that stood the test of time. Although I'm wondering actually whether some of the younger listeners will consider Stevie Wonder still to be in any way contemporary. But
he's still alive.
He is still alive, and he's had something like a 50-year career, hasn't he? So he's inspired a whole bunch of contemporary musicians. He's sampled all the time. So I'm still going with Stevie Wonder on this one. So, Jeff, what's your Stevie Wonder for case studies?
Well, my Stevie Wonder is the fact that testimonials can become the centerpiece of a campaign that either kind of defines the corporate brand or helps lay the groundwork for, you know, some new solution area or industry you're going into. So, you know, you're trying to prove skeptical prospects that your business has what it takes to serve their needs. And I mean, there've been lots of examples of this through the ages, but the one that springs most to mind because they're in the software business was SAP. They had this best bills businesses run on SAP, you know, so insert the name of the business runs on SAP.
Yeah.
And that went on for, I think actually in some way, shape or form is they're still running it. So it's been well over a decade. But you know, it's like, you know, being this big, often thought of as kind of a monolithic ERP system. They wanted to prove that they, you know, help businesses run efficiently and that they can do it down mid-market as well as for big brands. And I know a decade earlier, I was working at Progress Software. We came up with something similar that was like, insert the name of the business, makes progress. And because we were trying to do somewhat the same thing, but also associate a company that had a lesser known brand like Progress with bigger innovative companies. So it's in some ways, I mean, I think people might think that it's kind of old hat, but you know, with a new contemporary spin on it, I think it's invaluable and does stand the test of time.
I agree. I mean, that's the other side of it. I mean, the two things I love about this is one of them is using testimonials as the centerpiece of a campaign. So you've already got your proof points. Like if I'm putting together a content marketing campaign, I always say, well, how do you prove it? What are the proof points? What are the features? What do the customers say? And all that kind of stuff. And this is going bottom up and starting with that proposition, which I really like. And then the other part you were saying, which is what a case study does, is it associates you with this other brand, right? And especially if they're bigger than you. It's like, you know, I was working with a smaller vendor who was working with Jaguar Land Rover, and it was like, it's, you know, you, the trust that's in that, that you create from that. And that's one of our marketing mottos, isn't it? We need to create trust. So,
we need to create trust.
I love that.
So what is your Stevie Wonder?
My Stevie Wonder. I just realized my Stevie Wonder might not be a classic that stood the test of time, because I think it might be more of a contemporary idea, but it should have been, it should stand the test of time.
It will be.
Yeah. And I'm sure that there are in the old marketing books that are behind me, I'm sure that we've always talked about the customer being the hero, or the customer being the center of our marketing, right? So I'm sure that we can find some old quote that talks about that. But that's the thing, is that we always talk about the customer being the hero of our content marketing, and this is an ideal opportunity. So it's a bit of an extension of what I've shared just a moment ago, really, is that we write these case studies inside out. You know, there was a problem, we rode in, saved the day, and we solved it, right? And so, but I don't think a prospective customer aspires to be a user of your product or service. They aspire to be like the person who's in the case study, who solved the problem, who bought the product, yeah, who's got to where they need to be. So you really need to make that that the protagonist, that the hero, the person that solved the problem with your software, because that's the person the buyer wants to be. Whether, you know, the successful executive CMO or whoever it is you're featuring in, the story has to be about them. And it's how they see themselves. They're free of anxiety. They're free of risk. They've made the right decision. It's been successful. They're being lauded within their business. They've been, if they're quoted in a case study, they might be being lauded in their category, right? And it answers a lot of the questions of their boss might be having as they're going down the buyer's journey. So absolutely making the customer the hero is my Stevie Wonder.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a couple companies, I think, where we took that tack because the people who were the primary buyer were the champion, you know, to use sort of the generic persona term. And oftentimes these champions were looking to make a mark in their business, you know, whether it was in banking or insurance or whatever. And so, you know, the more you can turn them into, you know, I hesitate to say media celebrity, but it's like, you know, they all want the attention. Mm-hmm. You know, they're looking for what's their next step and whether they can maybe, I did it at this company and I'm going to go do it at the next company and I'm going to do it at the next company. Yes. And so it makes a lot of sense to find out who those people are and then leverage them as much as you can.
Well, I also think that goes back to something we're always talking about, Jeff, and that is needs, right? So it's identifying... Yep. What is the need of the buyer? And the buyer has a career need. They have this need to be seen, to be on stage, to be talked.
Absolutely.
And a case study is a great way to start on that. All right, so that's how Stevie Wonders. Quite pleased with this.
We should tell Stevie Wonder. I think he might ask for some royalties.
Well, it depends. Name. If somebody can come up with an artist or a wonder that's timeless that isn't Stevie Wonder, I'll be, because it's got to be a wonder. So if the listener,
it's got to be a wonder. Yeah,
I'm good.
Taylor Swift, right. Wonder.
Yeah, but then I'm going to have to come up with three Swifts or three Taylors or something,
you know,
for our alliteration to work. Anyway, so the last one is our Wonderwall. So, like I mentioned at the beginning, this is this is advice from an imaginary friend who's going to come and save you from yourself. So what's your tip to save the marketer from themselves, Jeff?
Well, it's funny because when you defined it as an imaginary friend, my brain went to was anonymous testimonials, you know. So, and actually a client I've been working for recently, they have all these, you know, large hospital in New York City uses, you know, blank to save lives and money you know, again, this is another thing that is, it's not that it has no value, but sometimes it implies that you don't have the relationship to enable you to use the name. You know, either you can't get the sign off from the legal team or the champion doesn't want to necessarily be associated with you guys or, you know, for whatever the reasons are. But, you know, and also it means that one of the things that's so effective in testimonials and case studies is attributable quotes, you know. A certain person, you know, whether it was the decision maker, the champion or whatever, they said something about the solution, your company, whatever. So if you can't get those attributable quotes, then it's like, it just kind of lacks oomph, if you will. And sometimes, you know, there are industries that won't reveal vendor names, you know, oftentimes defense contractors or, you know, and I think pharmaceuticals, I mean, there's certain businesses that are very reluctant to say, here's the vendors we work with. But then I think you go back to what your Stevie Wonder was, which you look for ways to get the client public that doesn't necessarily offend their legal constraints. It doesn't, you can be associated with them without necessarily them going out and making a explicit promotion. I mean, maybe they're speaking at a conference or on a webcast. We've certainly done that. I've done that with a lot of people who were not able to give us a, you know, publishable PDF case study or put their logo on our website or something like that. So, but, you know, it gets them out talking about a solution, and maybe you can create some sort of material, you know, based on that, that is, again, it doesn't offend their legal constraints, but it helps you or helps your sales reps to say, look, this, you know, this is the customer we really did this for. And look, they talk at this conference and this is what they said.
Yeah, no, I agree in a way. It depends on the kind of organization you're on and where you are with this. One of the things I would say to push back on this, and for a start, what you've just discussed there is there's two objectives with the case study, right? One is to tell the story and so that the prospective customer can get a sense of what the journey is going to be like and what they'll be on. And the other part is, as you say, to get that brand attribution and credibility and trust, which obviously an anonymous testimonial doesn't do. But it does, I think, tell the story in a better way. So let's imagine you can't get somebody to approve a case study. Telling that story might be a better way for a prospective buyer to learn about your solution than reading your features and functions and product pages, right? It's a nice way to tell the story, I think.
Agree.
If you think of it like that, I think. And the other one is how many times, Jeff, have we been in situations where so many customers want testimonials and they want references and they want case studies to read, but will they bloody give them? It drives me nuts, right?
You got to give to get, you know.
Yeah. So everybody wants to read the case study, but they won't give them, and it's such a shame, because I've worked with you know, some really good vendors, and they've got some really amazing clients, and it would be great for other people, other prospects, to learn that story. And of course, that story only gets told in closed doors, because the sales guy always reveals who the anonymous case study is.
And
right?
You know, I can think of companies that, you know, kind of direct competitors with each other, and one has got like case studies all over their website with logos and stuff like that, and the other doesn't, whether anonymous or not. And what would the impression be if I'm shopping? I'm going to be able. Yeah. I don't know. These guys have a lot of lot of people like to work with them.
No, I agree, but I'm thinking like some early stage and smaller vendors, they don't have a choice, right? So no big brand is going to admit to working with them in that public way. They haven't earned that credibility with them. But like I say, I think I'd rather see in an early emerging market with a startup, a story told on their website, even if it was anonymous. It's suboptimal, I agree, but I wouldn't say don't do it necessarily.
Absolutely.
It depends on the market, doesn't it? But I like that.
So what's your Wonderwall?
The piece of advice I would give to save people from themselves is the fact that quite often we think of a case study as one asset, one and done. It's the 2-page PDF, 4-page PDF. It's the video. It's this. It's one asset. And then the thing that you discover when you try and do case studies, the hard bit is the approvals. Now, if you try and what you need to do is try and capture as much as possible in that initial asset you create with the client and get it all approved as a bunch. What you can end up doing is you could get the 2-page, 3-page, 4-page thing approved, and you can only use the quotes in the context of the case study, or you can only say this, whatever. So make sure that's all broken out, and it's like a componentized content package that you're getting approved, not just the case study. And then you can inject that into various campaigns. And as I was saying, a good case study is going to serve you well throughout the customer journey, but you don't want to insist everybody reads 5 pages. You just want those snippets that you can also do. And then what I think you can do is once you can think of a case study as like a little Lego set, you can then take the pieces of that Lego set and build out a thought leadership piece based on a bunch of case studies. You've got a lot more flexibility there with that. So that's my advice to people to save them from themselves. Go for those approvals.
That's a good one. And I think the other thing is to think about the release form, you know, so when you're trying to get the approval, be explicit as to what is inclusive of their approval and what might be, what do I need to go back for, you know, if I don't know, let's say I got a whole bunch of written stuff done and then I wanted to go back and do a video. Exactly. So at that point, do I need to get reapproved you know, it's just be clear about it. And so that they know up front and they don't get surprised.
particularly is, and let's face it, it's quite often a case study, there will be a commercial incentive around it, right? So be really clear about, okay, so we're going to give you a discount or some service days or whatever it is that we're doing in return to getting this case study. And come on, don't tell me you didn't know that happened already. And that contract needs to be very clear as well. What you're agreeing to is going to be this number of quotes, this video, this written piece, and that's the whole package that we're going to go through. So I think that's important. Although in every customer contract, that shit gets redlined out. So
yes.
I'm back on my rant about how everybody wants case studies, but nobody wants to give them. All right. So we come to the, so that was great. Thank you, mate. I think that might work. We might do that again. So that was our one hit wonders, our Stevie Wonder and our Wonderwalls. I won't do the recap. We'll do a blog post or something, right?
So when we pick a song, is it going to be a one hit wonder, a Stevie Wonder or a Wonderwall?
I was thinking, because Stevie Wonder is new to this, right? We've done the Wonderwall a few times, we've done one hit wonders a few times, so I wonder if I don't know, and whether we dip into the vault of Stevie Wonder songs. What would you think would fit this?
I think we do.
We do. There's a clue. There's a clue. There's a clue there.
Yes, I think we agreed on a song called Do I Do from 1982. Mm-hmm. A lot of alliteration going near. Do I do? Do I do? What do you do? What you do? Yes. And it, but it is a case study in and of itself.
Yeah, it sounds like a case study. And I'm glad that you got to, I was going to try and say the lyric, do I do? Do I do? What you do? What you do? Is definitely a case study. I was going to try and avoid that. So that's splendid. Thank you very much, Jeff. And will you be in the studio? Or will I be? Will we be in the studio?
Yeah, really. I think we will.
Excellent.
Yes.
I'll see you then. Cheers, mate.
See you then. Bye. When I see you on the street, my whole body gets weak. When you're standing in the crowd, your love dog so loud, girl, do I do what you do when I do my love to you?
Thank you, Jeff. That was a tiny snippet of Do I Do from Stevie Wonder, and I hope you like that structure. We'll try that again. I really think case studies are the very best kind of content marketing we can do. And if we can help, or you'd like to explore some of the ideas we discussed, drop us an email at hello@rockstarcmo.com or contact us via our website. Right, it's that time of the week to wind down in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar and join Chief Troublemaker at the Content Advisory, Robert Rose, for a cocktail and a marketing thought. Good evening, Roberts. What are you drinking?
Ah, hello, my friend, and welcome to the bar. And I hold on just a second here. You have repurposed this place again. And what I can see now is that your fascination with American football must just be crazy, because you've turned this into a Dallas Cowboys bar, and I'm so pleased with that. I'm very happy that you've done it, and I pity you trying to go find all sorts of Dallas Cowboys sounds for the ambience. But this is fantastic. I really like it.
Cowboys, yeah. I kind of fed that one to you a bit. I mean, because I never know what you're going to say to this bit. I kind of fed that to you last week, didn't I, with my bumbling around trying to talk about American football. So it's time I learned, right? And what better way than just turn the whole bar into a Cowboys-themed bar and invite you fans in.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'm going to get a great American football education from all these good folks.
There you go. That's fantastic. So we have a wonderful drink for this weekend. And we're going to keep it really simple here, because I have been on a bit of a tear through the Italian countryside on wines. It is the only wine I know. I don't know French wines at all. I don't know Spanish wines. I know a lot about California wines for the obvious reason, but Italian wines are my jam. And of course, the Montalcino region being my favorite, which is Tuscan wines, basically, but, you know, specifically within Tuscany, Montalcino. And of course, my favorite within that, the Brunellas. And, you know, little known fact that, you know, for those of you who are interested in wine, so the Brunello di Montalcino, there are requirements basically for any wine to be called a Brunello, which of course is that it's, so the normal Brunellos are 5 years, have to be 5 years old. You will not find a real Brunello that is less than 5 years old. And if it's a reserve, it needs to be 6 years old. And at least two of those need to be in oak aging barrels. So, and it's 100%. This is the thing about Brunellos are that they are 100% Sangiovese wine. And it's just, I mean, they are it's my favorite wine of all time. It can be, I totally understand that for many people, they can be a little too big, too, you know, sort of, I guess, flavorful, if you will, if that's the right word to say to it, but just big is the is the general idea. But that is what we are having tonight. We are having my favorite of all of the Brunello di Montalcinos, which is basically the Poggioni. The Poggioni is the Reserva we're going to be having from 2016, and it's not cheap wine, but it is absolutely spectacular.
I love it. And I'm right there. And always spending any time with you and having dinner, we always drink very well when it comes to the wine. So I can almost taste it. I love it. So where are we going to be sipping this very fine wine?
Well, you know, I mean, we went to Italy last week. Yes. And so we were there for our, you know, for our sweet martinis. But I think we're not going back to Italy for this. This, I think we need to be somewhere, you know, with a wine of this caliber.
Yes.
You have to be in a great steakhouse. Oh. And so since you've actually done the amazing thing of transforming the bar into the Dallas Cowboys bar here, I'm assuming there's a great steakhouse attached right here to the virtual bar. So I think we are going to be in a Texas fantastic steakhouse, enjoying steaks that are far too large for our appetites.
Yes.
But then enjoying that with a little bit of this Brunello di Montalcino.
Oh, that's amazing. I think this must be the classiest Dallas Cowboys bar ever.
Oh, my friend, wait till you get an education in the Dallas Cowboys bars. Yes, there are classy ones, but I would not say that this is not the classiest. But the competition would be thick.
I think perhaps my judgment of American sports bars might be slightly colored, and so or from our own, you know, football bars that we have here, sports bars we have here. So I have to go with you that there are some classy Dallas Cowboys bars and steak restaurants, and we're in one of those. It sounds fantastic. So obviously we will spend most of the evening talking about your favorite topic in this bar, which is obviously going to be the Dallas Cowboys, as you give me a good education about how a chap can throw the ball from one end of the field to the other. But once we're exhausted with that, which I don't think we ever would, and the topic turns to marketing, what are we going to talk about this week?
We are going to talk a little bit about audiences. And basically, so here's the thing.
Yes.
One of the themes of my new book that seems to be resonating fairly well is, you know, and we've talked about it on this show before, is the idea of how content marketing is really becoming marketing.
Yes.
And or vice versa, depending on, you know, basically the chocolate and the peanut butter are coming together into one thing. And I'm struck by the idea of this because I'm starting to see modern definitions of modern marketing, and it looks very much like content marketing. So, for example, McKinsey, right? So I know McKinsey is kind of a joke these days, but McKinsey, right? One of the highest recognized consulting firms on the planet. And this is their definition of modern marketing. They say modern marketing is the ability to harness the full capabilities of the business to provide the best experience for customers and thereby drive growth. Mm-hmm. That sounds like content marketing to me. Or even the American Marketing Association, their explainer. So their definition is, marketing is the activity, set of institutions, and processes for creating, communicating, delivering, and exchanging offerings that have value for customers, mm-hmm. clients, partners, and society at large. Mm-hmm. In other words, delivering value through content. And then the Content Marketing Institute's definition of content marketing, just compare this. I mean, I wrote this, so it's a little bit of, you know, so... leading the witness duly noted. Content marketing is a strategic approach focused on creating and distributing valuable, relevant, and consistent content to attract and retain a clearly defined audience and ultimately drive profitable customer action. So those feel similar, right? And we can see this happening where many marketing organizations are now becoming what I would call owned media, you know, basically, in other words, it's really about how do we optimize the media we're creating, whether it's owned in a focused way, rented in some ways of paid media, et cetera, or even social, which is arguably declining very quickly. But those kinds of things are really the heart of any marketing operation these days, is how are we creating and optimizing the content that we're creating for valuable experiences for audiences. Now, here's the challenge, because what we're still doing, what many businesses are still doing, are conflating the idea of my marketing database with my audiences. And so when we think about the differences between an audience and a marketing database, we have to remember, and you can literally go to the Merriam-Webster definition of audience and look at it, which is, are they willingly and enthusiastically consuming our content, or are they doing so based on a transaction or only during the need which they have in buying? And that's the key, is that audiences might be part of your leads, your opportunities, your qualified leads, whatever you're doing, but it's higher in the hierarchy. And we have to become an organization focused on attracting and retaining audiences, some of whom will become marketing leads and opportunities and ultimately customers. And the way I say it in the book, and the way that I would sum this up, is that all audiences are customers, right? We just have to redefine how we look at the customer relationship. So all audiences are customers. Some of them will buy our products and services. So it's expanding our definition of the word customer to include audiences as well in modern marketing.
Right. And you were also talking about this when you were interviewed by Douglas Burdett on his show, the Marketing Book Podcast, when you were talking about your book with him. And I thought that was really interesting. And you were also talking about an audience that you might be educating and might be advocating for you, but they're not going to become customers, but they're still an important part of the audience you need to address, right?
Exactly. It's different needs, right? It's different. You know, and what, there's a shift in mindset, and we've talked about this on the show before, which is when you think about the idea of audiences and what we're creating with the content-driven experiences that we create, it is taking a product-minded, sort of perspective on it. In other words, If you take it seriously, if a business takes this seriously, this idea of marketing and looking at audiences and attracting them and et cetera, and becoming more of a resource for their customers than just a resource for buying X, Y, or Z widget, well, then basically what that means is that we have to look at those content experiences, every content experiences, as we would a product. In other words, our email newsletter becomes just as important as our product or service. Our website becomes just as important as our product or service. It needs the same care, the same attention, the same budgets, the same kind of patience for distribution, the same, you know, all of the things that we would put into a great product we have to put into these content-driven experiences, or else why are we making them? And that becomes the key. In other words, they can't just be, you know, they need to be agile and they need to be quick, and then we need to be have the ability to pivot quickly because we don't know in many cases. Yeah. But that's the same with product development. And so looking at it as sort of the, you know, the as they would say in the UK, the ginger-haired stepchild is basically not the way to look at developing these experiences. So if you're going to develop a podcast, it better be a considered, you know, a considered launch. It better be, you better think about it and think it through and do those things, because we need to look at it in a similar way. And so that's how we start building audiences that can expand and add wealth to our business that go well beyond just the sale of transactions. And there's plenty of examples of that out there.
Yeah, yeah. And there's two thoughts that come to mind there. One of them is your definition of how organizations need, because you mentioned owned media just a moment ago, but how organizations need to think about themselves as media companies. Previously, I've talked about the fact that every company, a company's second business is as a publisher, and they need to be audience first on that. But define what you mean by, because I know you've got a distinct point of view about how companies need to think about themselves as media companies. Describe that.
Describe the which part?
The fact that you believe that we need to think of ourselves as media companies, but it isn't just about being a media company. It is not the way that
it's a great distinction, because what we typically think of is you know, when we say, well, we need to be more like a media company, or we need to be more like a publishing company, and we can see, you know, we need to build that capability into our marketing and sales. And what people tend to immediately gravitate toward is we're a marketing organization. How do we market ourselves like a media company? You know, how do we add that capability? Yeah. And it's not that. It's not how do we create marketing materials like movie trailers, or, you know, the kinds of things that a marketing company would create in order to market their next movie or their next book or their next TV show or their next podcast or whatever event or whatever it is. That's fine. It's fine. But honestly, media companies have the same problems that we all do, right? In terms of their marketing, you know, sales guys that don't get it, you know, and people, you know, silos and all the measurement problems. They have all the same issues. The key is in how they operate. In other words, how do they operate as a media company? And so the fundamental there, and there are many, you know, sort of nuances that we can talk about, but the fundamental difference is operating like a media company means treating our content products with the same care and feeding that we do everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thought that I had from what you were describing too was when you were talking about launching, treating things like us as a product, is that needs marketing. Right, it needs investment in the promotion, and that you can't just stand these things, hope the world, you can't build them and hope the world comes, right? They need that product launch, that MVP. What are you going to do next? What are you going to think about, and how are you going to promote it?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll give you an example of that. So I had, this is a couple of years ago, but I had a conversation with a CMO of a very large, very, very large financial services company. They have credit cards, they have consumer credit cards, business credit cards, they got, you know, auto loans. They're, you know, they're a big bank basically. And, you know, and they spend millions of dollars in television advertising. You know, and when I say millions of dollars, I mean tens of millions of dollars in TV, you know, flights, you know, media buys, but also millions of dollars in the content creation of those. You know, they pay big celebrities and they do the things and they do all the things that we would expect, right? And the content team who was responsible for the website was looking to get money for a video on the front page of their website. And were struggling to get the business to recognize that they wanted to spend about 25 or 30 grand on a video for the front page of the website. And when you looked at the traffic of the website, it was getting millions and millions and millions of views every month. Right? The same number, by the way, that they were getting in their, roughly the same number that they were getting in their TV advertising flights.
Wow.
And so when I asked the CMO, I said, why are they struggling to get 25? I'm not suggesting, you know, your production value on your TV commercials let's say you're putting a couple of million dollars into those things, right? Paying the celebrity, full production sets, et cetera. I'm not suggesting that the video on the front page of your website should cost $1 million, but I'm also suggesting that it probably could. In other words, you're getting the same number of eyeballs on them, but you're treating your owned media as if it's not working media. Okay. And we have to understand that all of our media is working media these days.
I love it. I love it. Excellent. Well, brilliant as usual, mate. We wandered off the audience topic that we started talking about, but I guess that's because of this wonderful wine that we're drinking or the distraction with the steak or the Dallas Cowboys. But when people are looking for the owned media that you own, where might they find that?
Well, they'll find us in two places, our own owned media experiences, where we're in one, we're building audiences, and the other, we're actually selling stuff. So they're two parts of the buyer's journey, if you will. One is our website, which, of course, is contentadvisory.net, where you can learn all about our consulting and the things that we do for clients. And then, of course, there's the accessory, I would call it, to my book, Content Marketing Strategy. Which offers all sorts of free templates and free things once you sort of join the community there. No spam, as I like to say, just good stuff, hopefully. That's at contentmarketingstrategy.com. And of course, we have our coaching is up there as well, where you can literally buy an hour of our time if that's something that you want to do.
Very nice. And very nice. And also, I meant to mention this last week, your Rose Colored Glasses column on Content Marketing Institute has now got your voice on it, which I think is really interesting because we've been talking about AI the last few weeks and I've forgotten to mention that.
It's an experiment. It's an experiment for sure. It's a little unnerving, I have to be honest with you, to listen to it because it does sound like me. Now, I played it for my wife without telling her. And she could tell the difference. She goes, that's not you. And I went, oh, that's interesting that you could hear it. But I dare say that it would be difficult for anybody who doesn't know me well to not be able to tell the difference.
Yeah. Well, a little while back, Seth Godin did an episode of his podcast doing the same thing. I haven't tried it yet. I'm really curious. I'm going to have a look at that. So I might ask you about the technology you're using there. I did do the portrait thing where I got it where I got the thing to do some portraits of me. And one of my daughters was like completely freaked out by it. She's like, that's just weird. Don't do that anymore. So it's quite funny. But anyway, so, and then when people spin the dial on the interwebs, where are they going to find you, man?
LinkedIn. And Threads are the best place.
Splendid. And we chatted about that last week. And most importantly, will I find you in the bar next week, mate?
Oh, you will indeed. You will indeed.
I look forward to it.
Hopefully you're going to just keep this place as a Cowboy.
I should, especially if you keep your winning run going. I should do that. All right, mate.
Yeah.
I'll see you then. Cheers. Thank you, Robert, and his Cowboys continue to win. And we open there with their cheerleader's signature tune, Thunderstruck. So that's a wrap on episode 194 of the Rockstar CMO Epic Marketing Podcast. I've been your host, Ian Truscott. Thanks to Jeff and Robert for sharing their insight and to you for dropping a dime into your podcasting jukebox, selecting our track and jiving along with us. You can find links to me, Jeff and Robert and their work in the show notes on rockstarcmo.com along with our blog newsletter and all of our previous episodes. Please say hello to them, drop us a rating or review in your favourite podcast app or just keep listening. I'm glad you're here. Next week, Jeff will be back in the marketing studio and we'll be giving thought leadership the three wonders treatment. And as you heard, Robert will be back in the bar. Until then, have a great week and I hope you again join us here next week on Rockstar CMO. FM.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.